Thank you very much for joining us this evening. My name is Paul Steggy. I'm the faculty director of the LePage Center and associate professor of history here at Villanova. Before we begin our program, I just want to offer a few thank yous for some of the people that made this possible. A special thanks to Jenny Waldman, the program specialist in the LePage Center, for all of her work to help make this happen. I also want to thank our two student fellows, Keely Tullio and James Lyons, for their work, along with the graduate students who are assisting us this evening, Lori Weissong, Chris Mengel, and Kyle Skripko. Additional thanks to Laura Bang and Rebecca Oviedo from the Distinctive Collections section at the Villanova's Falvey Library, who organized and provided the historical documents that you were able to look at on your way in and provided a foretaste, I guess, of some of our ways of reimagining and thinking about the Cold War. Also, let me just take a quick moment to provide the obligatory 21st century reminder to please silence your electronic devices. You may keep them running if you so choose, because we are going to be live tweeting this event. And if you are interested in contributing your two cents to the conversation, or repudiating, or expressing your enthusiasm, you can do so. Our hashtag for this and all LePage events is LePage at VU. Before I introduce our speakers, a couple of words about the format of this event. So this is the third in a series that we have been running this year on revisionist history. And this is a term that certainly in public usage tends to have a whiff of the dangerous about it, as something that perhaps is departing from authentic or truthful versions of history and heading towards perhaps if not the fictional, at least the dubious. And what we've been trying to do this year is to explore the ways in which, in fact, revising is part and parcel of the work that historians do. And actually, it's quite appropriate in terms of the Cold War, in terms of thinking about documents and the process of declassification. I'm actually going to steal a line from one of our panelists, David Barrett, in the introduction to one of his recent co-authored books, Until the Paper Trail is Exhausted, the History of Any Event is Subject to Revision. Given the fact that there always seem to be more documents to discover or more angles to take, it seems like this is an ongoing process. So tonight our topic is the Cold War, perhaps something that may seem familiar or maybe something to dive into anew for you. What we're going to do as we try to explore this is to begin by having an initial conversation with the three panelists on stage, and that will take about 30 minutes or so. At that point, we'll invite our fourth panelist, in case you were wondering about the empty chair on the stage, to provide a few thoughts or responses that will allow us to think through what we've said to that point. And then we will reconvene and include all of the people here at the stage to think about what we've said so far and what we've gotten right and what we've gotten wrong and wrestle with it a bit before then turning things over to you and giving you all a chance to ask questions and pose comments. Before at 8:30 on the dot or so, we will adjourn back out to the atrium for some refreshments and an opportunity for you to speak to and ask questions of the speakers to your leisure, at least as long as their endurance holds out. So I am going to keep my introductions quite brief, because you've had the opportunity to sort of read the circulating bios that have been going on the screen as you're going through. And what I'm going to do is just click through these here for a second and give you one last chance to look and put pictures with the people that I'm introducing. And then we will go ahead and get started. So to my immediate left is Alex Wellerstein, who is a assistant professor and David and Gigi Farber faculty fellow in science and technology studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. In the middle, Meredith Oyen is associate professor of history and the director of the Asian Studies Program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Manu Bhagavan is professor of history and human rights at Hunter College in the Graduate Center in CUNY and senior fellow at the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies. And in a few minutes, we will be joined on stage by David Barrett, who is professor of political science at Villanova University. I apologize for my juggling and my watch, but I'm going to try to keep us on schedule. I am a German historian after all, so we have to do that. Before we begin, in 3 days we will commemorate the 30th anniversary of the opening of the Berlin Wall, a moment that, in symbolic terms at least, seemed to bring to an end this international conflict, the Cold War that dominated the second half of the 20th century. So within 2 years, the Soviet Union was gone, and it seemed like that battle was in the past. But what was that battle really about? Perhaps if we linger in Berlin for just a moment, but take a few steps backward in time, we can at least think about some of the ways that those questions were posed. I think now we tend to have a certain kind of nostalgia looking back at the Cold War to imagine it as a time period which, while perhaps dangerous or threatening, at least was comprehensible, that we knew what it was about or we knew the stakes of this conflict. But I want to suggest that perhaps that was a product of the Cold War as well. And so as a way of introducing or entering into this conversation, I want to mention a speech given by American President John F. Kennedy in West Berlin in June of 1963, most famous for his comment that ich bin ein Berliner, so I am a Berliner, which for the record does not mean that I'm a jelly donut. But nonetheless, I want to reference another line from the speech where he said that anybody who wanted to understand what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world should come to Berlin. And his presumption was that if you came to Berlin and you saw the Berlin Wall and you saw this east-west divide, that what the Cold War was about would go without saying. And what we're going to try to do tonight is perhaps to push back against that notion that the Cold War is a subject that goes without saying. And so without further ado, let's dive in and see where we wind up. So let me start. Actually, I'm going to ask Manu to kick us off here. And I'm ask a rather kind of pointed and probably simplistic question. So who won the Cold War?
Glad to start with an easy one. So good evening, everyone. And Paul, thank you for the introduction. Thanks also to Jason and the LePage Center for having us and to my distinguished colleagues on the panel. So I think the easy answer is that you start, in order to answer who won the Cold War, you start with, well, who was fighting the Cold War? And if your answer is it's a battle between the United States and the Soviet Union, then one of them, none of them, both of them, somebody won. But if we start from a different perspective and we say the Cold War affected people all over the world, there was a Cold War world, then who is winning and who's losing can look a little bit different. If we also think about the Cold War as a battle between two powers with the threat of total destruction and absolute annihilation as a possibility, then we have conflicts going on right now that could still result in that. So I'm a specialist on India. and South Asia more broadly. So in our neighborhood, we have two nuclear countries, which are constantly eyeball to eyeball. And where that might wind up is pretty scary. So I would say, with that as a background, India has often been thought of as marginal to the Cold War, but in my work, I sort of position it very differently, that it was actually situated particularly between the superpowers and saw itself as a moderating force that was constantly in dialogue with both of them, and something that was trying, a country that was trying to mitigate conflict. At the root of India's policies was the idea that in order for the world to move forward through the Cold War and eventually to surpass it, they had to beat back the principal force of the old world, which was imperialism. As the Cold War unfolded, I think they came to the realization, as did many other countries, that imperialism not only did not die at the end of World War II, that it was reinvigorated and that it was manifesting itself through the Cold War in very new ways, very different ways. In which case, I would say that regardless of which country may have momentarily come out on top in the conflicts that I just highlighted to start out with, I would say the winner is imperialism.
So in this sense, a lasting legacy that is an ongoing story in terms of an imperial project of that begins before or ends with the Cold War. Maybe Meredith, we can turn to you a little bit in that same kind of broadening this story of who's part of this battle. If we think part of the question of who wins depends a little bit on articulating who is even playing the game, I guess. And in terms of thinking about, to pick up on this comment that Manu made about the legacy of imperialism, if your work focusing on kind of populations moving around East Asia and especially Chinese, to what extent is this language of empire, imperialism, or battles over empire a useful way of thinking about any of the people that you're encountering?
I mean, I would say that post-World War II, and actually starting during World War II, decolonization becomes one of the most important, I think, rubrics or overarching principles and ways of understanding what's happening in East Asia. And so for the next couple of decades, there's a lot that can be traced back to the legacies of imperialism and the the resurgence of imperialistic ideas through certain kinds of aid and military arrangements with either the United States or the Soviet Union. But that is a particularly useful and helpful overarching framework for understanding this region and this era. And I'd actually argue that the Cold War is a less useful device for understanding the area. That in fact, perhaps we, in our process of revising the Cold War and expanding it, trying to understand the global Cold War, that we actually go too far and we take everything that happened in the space of 4 or 5 decades and attribute it in some way, shape, or form to the Cold War. And that's, I think, particularly problematic when you look at things like the movement of people, migrations across East Asia in the 1940s and 1950s, where there's certainly Cold War events taking place around them, but their decisions of where they're moving and how they're moving and who's helping them move are actually not at all determined by a bipolar system. They're actually much more complex than that. So if you took the Cold War and defined it down, back down again, narrowly to a bipolar struggle, in which the United States and the Soviet Union are trying to define modernity for the rest of the world and increase the number of adherents to their side, and there is a threat of nuclear disaster that is underlying all of this, then you would situate that much more in Europe and look at events in Asia on their own terms and say, okay, these are events that are connected to the Cold War but not determined by it.
So you mentioned this idea of kind of the underlying science, technology, nuclear weapons, and thinking about the ways in which that becomes one of the backdrops for this competition between the Soviet Union, the United States, between these imperial powers. Maybe following on that line as well in terms of thinking about this underlying phenomenon of nuclear weapons and the technology of mass destruction that also was part of kind of Manu's comment as well. To what extent is that, in fact, even a Cold War phenomenon at all? Is that so in terms of thinking about nuclear weapons, is that something that we should put under the rubric of Cold War, or should we, we've decided here at the very beginning of our discussion, the Cold War is perhaps less useful than we thought, and we can just cast aside and talk about other stuff?
You know, an easy question, easy ones. There's a lot of discussion amongst historians and political scientists and international relations people who are looking back at the role of nuclear weapons in the Cold War. Do nuclear weapons cause the Cold War, or are they sort of a phenomena of the Cold War? And, you know, like anything complicated, it's both, right? I think that it's easy to sort of overemphasize nuclear weapons, and the reason it's easy to do that is because many of the, especially American and European and Soviet actors themselves emphasized them very heavily and thought they were very important. But I also think it's interesting that a lot of these same people later came to feel that that form of sort of hard deterrent power was less important than sort of their soft imperialism, right? These are the same people who are starting to conceive of concepts like world development and what if we shipped grain to these countries and made them dependent on us and then they would be able to resist communists. And they start to see that as the real battlefield, because with nukes, at some point you get really diminishing returns. You can kill yourself once, or you can kill yourself twice, or you can, you know, at some point you can add new systems, but you're not changing the fundamental dynamic at all. I would just say on the broader question, I mean, my revisionist hot take, if we want to have one, and I would be really interested in the panel, is even the term Cold War a useful one? I mean, I don't think it was very cold for many people. If by cold we mean we did not have thermonuclear war, that's a very like low bar for cold. We did not extinct ourselves. Good for us. But you know, millions of people died in the Cold War through these proxy conflicts and things like that. Like literally millions. Like not, that's not even an exaggeration. And then is it even a war is to me the big question, because in a war linguistically we mean that as sort of self-contained entity, even though our modern wars aren't that, but we sort of imagine that like there's a beginning and there's an end and there's a battle, and there were lots of wars in this period, some really hot and some really diplomatic and things like that, but at some point, I wonder if that's even a useful framing anymore. And again, I can see why they framed it that way at the time. I can see why that worked really well. But I find myself more and more thinking of it as a context, and I don't have a snappy name for it like Cold War. I mean, that's a good word, good term, in which a lot of things happen, some of which are related to the American-Soviet bipolar thing, and some of which are their own things that, as Meredith was saying, is, you know, sort of loop into that a little bit, but are really need to be considered is not necessarily a result of that bipolar interaction. So,
yeah, I mean, the revision of the history of the Cold War that started with the histories that were written while the Cold War is still going on has been to expand it and to expand the definition and to expand the coverage and to say, actually, all of these things are so connected. And so now you have histories of, you know, Cold War tourism and you know, going to the beach in the south of France is an act of Cold Warrior, you know, you can sort of make a case for it, and you can. To what extent do we define it so broadly now that we've robbed it of all of its meaning? And so now the next revision will be to narrow it back down again and say, here is a narrower definition of this world event that concentrated in Europe and, in fact, had repercussions for the rest of the world but wasn't determinative for the rest of the world.
So I'd like to respond to two things, one from Meredith and one from Alex. I'm struck already by how much the question and the answer to it is very field specific within the discipline of history. So I'm a South Asian historian, and South Asia, India, and Pakistan achieve independence in 1947. So their life histories as new nation states correspond to the beginning of the Cold War. They also exist in a bipolar reality, much as the larger Cold War exists in that, and eventually they become Cold War opposites. So there's a whole lot of micro and macro going on here. Nonetheless, what I find interesting is that up until very recently, one would not ask the question of how does India feel about the Cold War, because India had nothing to do with the Cold War. India's history as it was written was about a decolonizing country which was poor and which was trying to figure out how to deal with poverty and how to sort of deal with Gandhi's legacy and try to move on and become an independent country. That's the story. And also its dealings with democracy, its emergency, abrogation of the constitution, things like that. It's only very recently where India, as a sort of globalized potential superpower asserting itself on the world stage now, that it's reading back in time and can say, well, where is India's place in the world? Where has it been? How has India related to other countries? It turns out that one of the reasons why those questions couldn't have been asked any earlier is because all of the archives have been closed. So we had no, to David, to the line that Paul quoted from you, there were no documents. There was no paper trail. Hence, the only paper trail was about the domestic sphere. Now those documents are open, and we can write a very different kind of history. In which case, number one, I think India does have something to do with the Cold War. It was very central, actually. And number two, to your point now, it for India, and by India here in the 40s and 50s, we mean particularly the prime minister, that's Jawaharlal Nehru, who held the foreign ministry portfolio and the prime ministerial, he was prime minister and he held the foreign ministry portfolio. For him, the issue above all was nuclear holocaust. He thought that this was a threat to all existence. And this is very clear in all of the literature dating back to the 40s. And he's worried about that, and he sees India's key role, the role he can play. When India achieves independence, Gandhi is still alive. Nonviolence is key to how they conceptualize themselves, and Gandhi is sort of seen as a worldwide saint. He's dead 6 months into the new country, but his halo sort of gives a backlighting to Nehru, if you will. So Nehru has this glow about him, which gives him also this sort of saintly appearance to people. And so with this legacy of Gandhi, which is also a bit of a burden, he has this sort of nonviolence, he has this need to sort of perpetuate a notion of nonviolence around the world. And he sees that at his mission as to prevent humanity from destroying itself.
So just to pick up on that a little bit, and I think this also gets a little bit to Alex's point about the fact that during this time period, millions of people died. And so if part of the idea, and we think about Nehru as somebody who's pushing back against a bipolar system, pushing back against the conflict of the superpowers, kind of imagining a third way between East and West to some extent. But I wonder about this question, not just about imagined violence, not just about imagined nuclear holocaust, but also about the real violence that particularly happened in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and to what extent, if we're talking about whether or not this is a war or not, we need to think particularly about the levels of massive violence and how that happens and where it comes from. And if we talk about that violence, whether or not it has anything to do with this larger thing, Cold War, or is it about decolonization or about regional conflict or something like that?
Embrace the power of and. It's all of these things, right? Like, if you look at, I speak only to East Asia, but if you look at the Korean War and the Vietnam War, if you look at some of the conflicts that are going on internally within countries in Southeast Asia. It is a product of both decolonization and, in some cases, the Cold War and outside forces that have politics and policies that force them to make or cause them to make certain kinds of policy choices in these places, like the United States' role in some of these places. But it's also other things as well. It's also civil conflicts. It's also domestic issues. It's also technological change and different visions for modernity and what the future should look like and what kinds of economic systems. So there's lots of causes to this violence, and I think that by reducing it, I'm not suggesting that you are, but we have a tendency to sort of, you know, attribute all of these deaths and all of these conflicts to this sort of broad general idea of the Cold War, and it's giving, I think, a little too much power to that conflict and not enough agency to people on the ground who have other issues that are playing at the same time.
So could I just pick up on that just a little bit more in terms of thinking about the agency of other people, even in terms of agency, whether we're talking about scientists, whether we're talking about migrants, to think about what they're doing and what they're motivating, and to what extent can we think about them as participants, as subjects of the Cold War, as opposed to objects of the Cold War? In other words, part of this is a question to say, all right, for your Chinese migrants that wind up in different places across East Asia or the United States, can we label them Cold Warriors? Are they doing Cold War in anything of what they're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some great cases of that, but it's cases of people saying, I see the Cold War as an opportunity, right? So there's an example, I use an example in my book of a man in San Francisco who's arrested for violating U.S. immigration laws. He helps people come in undocumented, and so he gets arrested and he spends a couple years in jail, and then he's supposed to be deported. And at that point, it's just a domestic story. It has something to do with, you know, legal issues and legalities and breaking local law. And then what he does is he appeals to the government of the Republic of China and on Taiwan and says, you know, I am fighting for you here in the United States, and I'm promoting the Republic of China and the nationalist vision in San Francisco. I'm a leader in the city. And they become invested in the idea that he can't be deported because he is a cold warrior in San Francisco who's promoting the nationalist cause. Right, but that's not a case of the Cold War determining his future. It's a case of him using the context of the Cold War to try and achieve the end of not being deported, right? And so there's examples of this. I think that happen at sort of all levels. People in Hong Kong who use the environment and the climate and the context of the Cold War to say, well, we're not economic migrants leaving China. We're in fact anti-communist, therefore we appeal to you for aid. So I think that there's lots of examples of the Cold War impinging upon or coming into these stories, but it's not necessarily because the Cold War has caused them.
Could I just say, I mean, my feeling of if we want to ask everybody what they even feel the Cold War was or things like that, but for me it's less, again, this bipolar thing, but sort of a form of loose power. This is how I think of it. You get a couple countries where this power is very concentrated. For economic reasons, for political reasons, the Soviet Union, the United States, they've got a lot of power. But a lot of other people have forms of power as well and can sort of tie into that. And this is where I think of the agency. The scientists do this all the time in the United States. There's all this money out there for Cold War projects. And so instead of saying the Cold War made the scientists study what they studied, these scientists, because they're clever people and they want money, think, how can I get the Cold War, they don't put it in these terms, to pay for what I want to do, right? And so they find a way to take what they probably already wanted to do and massage it into the priorities of their national governments, and then, you know, the money starts flowing. And I don't know if anybody in here is an academic, but we all do this today when we see a grant proposal out there. This is the sort of what happens when suddenly a free source of power or money is out there, and it says, you know, if you can convince me that your project will advance my project, then I'll help you. And this, to me, is a more useful model personally than the, like, you know, it's about anti-communism and communism and this sort of thing, because it also shows you to look where you're going to see other people buy in. You're going to see India coming in real strong, which they do, especially in science and technology areas, and say, you know, United States, somebody's going to help us build a reactor. Is it going to be you, or is it going to be the Soviets? And this is, again, like that nice looping in. And I think some of the really nice song play. I think some of the really nice sort of revisions of the Cold War of the 1990s, and I'd be interested if the panelists still think about this, have been all about returning that agency and saying, no, no, it's not the United States and the Soviet Union are bossing around a country like India. Occasionally they try. But it's often about these other places realizing that these guys are so pent up about their struggle that they can take advantage of that for their own purposes and get, you know, whether it's Egypt or India or China or a lot of other places.
So in that context, in thinking about India, and you mentioned Nehru before, but is his agency in this, or Indian agency in this, about using the Cold War or resisting these kind of bipolar structures? So to some extent, are we coming back to the idea which there is a bipolar ideological or oppositional component that helps to define the terms by which these different people, these different politicians, different agents, however we want to name them, are acting here? Or so maybe to put it in these simple terms, is Nehru using the Cold War, or is he resisting the Cold War?
So I'm again struck by something, just the general tenor of the conversation so far, which I think is a hallmark of our age and things, perspectives that we're going to naturally bring to it, which creates a problem with studying a place like India in the 40s and 50s, 60s, led by someone like Nehru. Nehru was, to his core, an idealist who also practiced political realism, but he was a high-minded idealist. And I can't overstate how much the shadow of Gandhi falls on this country. Gandhi had called on people to be truthful and have integrity and these kinds of things. Of course it wasn't perfect. Of course there were people who had different kinds of motives, but there really was, the documents just, whatever sources I use, it really sort of revealed that there really was this striving to live up to that thing. So, in other words, the cynicism that we bring, it's hard to look at these people through that lens and to, I think, be fair to them, because they're not seeing the world that way. And they're trying to do something else. They might be good or bad at it, but they're definitely trying, from their perspective, to be authentic about it. With that in mind, I'd say two things, which is, to the general point about scientists and coming back to what I said earlier, well, for example, two scientists kept Nehru in the loop fairly frequently, two prominent US scientists, one Albert Einstein, and the other Robert Oppenheimer. So Oppenheimer was knowledgeable still. And he contacted Nehru secretly in the 50s and said, look, terrible things are being developed here, which will make what we've seen in the 40s look like nothing. And it is terrifying. And only you can, it isn't so much about putting him on a pedestal. He just thought he was the only one with the stature to sort of stand up and say, don't go down this route. So Oppenheimer makes that plea. And in which case, again, yes, there's scientists asking for money, and yes, they're trying to fund projects, but at some point, they're also wary of what can happen if their work goes into the wrong hand or causes the wrong thing.
Can I just pick up on this question of, I don't know, idealism, this tension between idealism and realism, in terms of thinking about the ways in which on some level, even at the root of bipolarity, there is this idealism in terms of whether it's talking about the pursuit of democracy or the pursuit of socialism as these idealistic visions of the future that are, you know, driving kind of Soviet, American, European efforts to kind of cope with the challenges of the modern world. So is this the Cold War in this sense, this about misplaced idealism, and even the case of somebody like Oppenheimer, kind of in terms of his embrace with science, that has this vision of possibility, but also his idealistic response to it is also recognizing, or the fear or the danger that goes along with it. So are these, if we look at these different people, whether they're Soviets, Americans, Chinese, Indians, how does their vision of the future shape the ways in which, I mean, is there an ideology, an idealism that they share around these different places, or they have different hopes for what they're trying to achieve in at these moments in time?
I mean, Oppenheimer is really complicated, and I don't want to make it sound like everybody's just into money. I'm just using as an example of power being used to different ends. Oppenheimer is an idealist in some sense. He would like the world to be safer, but the route to that is, for him, is very complicated. It is not like unilateral disarmament or something like that. And sometimes it's things like, let's put tactical nuclear weapons in Western Europe, becomes one of his major recommendations. And you know, that's hard to square with sometimes the idea of Oppenheimer as being anti-nuclear or being that kind of idealist. In a way, and I don't want to talk all about Oppenheimer here, but since he came up. To me, Oppenheimer is in some ways a really interesting case study for this question of the balance of idealism and realism, because he does have a vision of the future, and he does, from the 1940s onward, think that if the world does not take nuclear weapons seriously, they are toast. They are totally toast. And if the United States just barrels in directions without thinking about it, everybody is going to die, which is a pretty big motivator. His way of getting there, though, is as an operator. He does all sorts of stuff behind the scenes. Throughout this entire period, he basically sets up the modern declassification system. So if you ever get irritated because they won't give you your documents, because some reviewer is looking at it, you can blame J. Robert Oppenheimer. He comes up with this with five other scientists, and no surprise, it's a terrible system. Like, five physicists came up with this whole system that we still use today. Who'd have thought that would work out? And he's tricky because he wants certain things, but he's also willing to sort of, he wants to do it in realistic terms. And this is why by the end of it, he gets very depressed and basically drinks himself to death for the rest of his life, because he can't do these things. The idealist loses, and the realist realizes it's too late and he failed everything. So, you know, I don't know if that's a leitmotif for the Cold War in general.
To drink yourself to death?
Drink yourself to death over the course of the 60s. But, I mean, he dies of cancer, but he would have probably drunk himself to death if that hadn't happened. But, anyway, this is kind of why I find, as an aside, the Cold War interesting. The figures are complicated, even when they're very idealistic. And I don't want to sound too cynical. I am pretty cynical. But I love idealistic figures who get into the position of actually being able to be power brokers and then suddenly realize that they can't just be idealistic, and that the broader context is going to sort of beat them into a shape. And then they usually leave all broken. And I find that really fascinating as a historian, and, you know, a referendum on the possibility of human redemption. But but I'm not cynical.
So on that note, we're about a half hour in, and so maybe we'll let David come up and explain what we've been thinking about so far, and see where it takes us.
Thank you, Paul. Hello, everyone. My scholarship relates especially to U.S. presidents and national security policy, especially the early to middle Cold War. So guess what? Some of my comments are reflective of the work that I've done and the research that I have done. The other thing is, I'm the oldest person, I'm the oldest person on this panel. I am a child of the Cold War. The Cold War extended in my lifetime from my earliest memories, and I remember radio reports when I was like 4 years old about the Russians and the bombs, and a few years later, Sputnik. I saw Sputnik going across the sky after sunset. You could see a little light going across the dark sky. And it Cold War extended into well into my 30s, I mean, the Reagan era, when I was in my 30s. So it was very real to me and remains very, very real to me. I said I'm a scholar of the presidency, and Baldwin, I hit 10 minutes to stop me. Otherwise, I'll never stop, but I'll gladly stop. I've spent a lot of time looking at what presidents have said in private, inside the White House, meeting with others about the Cold War, about the Soviet Union, about China. And I think there was something genuine about, something real about their belief that the other side, the Soviet Union especially, China in early decades, that they were the bad guys, that there was something sort of bad versus good going on. So they've talked about that a lot. But what also strikes me is how much presidents fretted about the U.S., the American domestic concept, the public's concept of the Cold War, and how they tended to sort of frame their thinking about Cold War events through the matter of winning re-election, or if it was a president in a second term, how the forthcoming election, even though there's someone else in their party running for president, how that would shape perceptions of their own presidential legacy. So a couple of specific things. Alice, you talked about that sort of low bar for the Cold War in the sense of, well, we didn't obliterate each other. But I mean, I think that's a very big thing. I mean, the American public went for decades, but not just the public. Elites, most of them at least, I think, thought this is a very real possibility. We could all die. We didn't. Well, you're right, of course. Millions died in the Cold War, absolutely crucial point. But the world itself, humanity itself, survived. And toward the end of the Reagan era, there were diplomacy to reduce the nuclear arsenals. I do wonder about, is the world better off these days, post-Cold War, in terms of nuclear weaponry? Because think of India and Pakistan, think of nuclear proliferation. So are we better off post-Cold War in terms of nuclear weaponry or not? It seems to me the answer is not obvious. I was thinking also about China and how some of those magazines out there are fascinating and sort of illustrating things about the Cold War. One of them was a display about China, I think from the maybe Korean War period. And it's fascinating how China was this sort of mysterious, evil sort of figure in the Cold War context until it wasn't in the Nixon era and really didn't have that sort of same scary status for the remainder of the Cold War period. And speaking of India, I was thinking, I've spent some time thinking about President Kennedy, but and other earlier Cold War presidents, India and the Cold War. I'm not surprised that those presidents were angry at the government of India for, in the American view, not taking the Cold War seriously. It seems to me perfectly logical that India would have taken what Americans called the neutralist sort of a route. But what surprises me is that American presidents absolutely, and this I mean this even in private, not just in what they said publicly, they could not understand why the Indian government would be neutral. As much respect as Kennedy had, for example, for Nehru, he was baffled by him and baffled by the policies of that government. One last comment. Again, I come back to presidents, but also the U.S. at large. This whole matter of the ending of the Cold War, what struck me then, and I still find myself surprised by it, there was no real celebration in the U.S. when this thing called the Cold War ended. There was no great national celebration. And I do think, even though it is a low bar in terms of winning the Cold War, I think there is this argument to be made, not just that the U.S. won, but that humanity was not just imperialism, but in some ways humanity was a winner because we're here. A lot of us are here. Not everyone is here, but we did not blow up the world. That's a good thing. Maybe that's under 10 minutes, but I'll stop there.
So anybody want to kind of have an initial response to what David threw out here, or?
Okay, well, thank you. That was very interesting. So I'll pick up on the American presidents were befuddled by India's position line. So to answer that, there's a couple of different pieces that I just have to lay out on the table. One is that Nehru, in the interwar period, was a staunch Democrat and a staunch anti-fascist. So he was enormously popular in the West, in Britain, and in the United States. And I can't describe to you the terms in which he was, how he was admired and where, how he was held up. But this was true across the ideological spectrum in the United States. Democrats and Republicans admired him very strongly. This then was magnified when his sister came here and helped lead a counter-delegation at the UN conference in San Francisco, and then became ambassador to Moscow, and then ambassador to Washington, and then high commissioner to London. Her name is Madame Pundit, and okay, disclaimer, I'm writing a biography of her. But she was extremely glamorous, extremely brilliant, and took up the oxygen of any room she was in. So she was able to defeat very prominent political players in debate. So she was also fearsome. So together they were a formidable pair. She was a celebrity in the United States. Across not just elites, not just politicians, I mean the general public knew who she was. And so why were people in the United States befuddled? Because they loved her, and she kind of loved, they seemed to think she loved them. And so they were like, wait, what? You were natural allies, what's going on here? From India's perspective, however, they were very concerned that alliances would only lead the world to a very dark place. The Soviet Union, Nehru was not starry-eyed. He was not starstruck by the Soviet Union by any means. He was very wary of Stalin. And although there was a peace initiative with Khrushchev and following, he was you know, sort of concerned. But at the same time, he said, what good would it do to shut down these channels? If we aren't here and able to talk to them, what will happen? Having said that, the last point I just make is, President Eisenhower did trust Nehru quite a bit. And one of the reasons is because Nehru and India in 1950 tried to open channels between the Soviet Union and the United States to put an end to the Korean conflict before it started. And initially they were told, stay out of this. But in 1951 and 52, as the war goes on, suddenly both sides are like, maybe. And so Nehru reaches out to Stalin. And Stalin says, okay. And so when that happens, then the United States also says, okay. And it is India, led by Krishna Menon at Nehru's behest, that negotiates the thing that becomes the armistice, which brings the Korean War to an end, and which holds to this day. And so that I think best illustrates why India felt it could never join one side or the other, because that, per what I had said earlier, they saw as their central role.
Could I just pick up, you want to jump in, go ahead.
Sure, I was gonna just say something about the enigma that is China until the 1970s and the Nixon trip. And I think China sort of belies the structure of the Cold War because it doesn't quite fit, right? It is so much the part of the Cold War. And you see that because every Every policymaker, every sort of elite thinker in the United States is absolutely thinking of China policy in terms of Cold War calculations. Are they, you know, they become communists, they're allied with the Soviet Union, what if they could reach out? There's some really fabulous propaganda videos about, you know, China reaching its red tentacles across the world, you know, and destroying everything in its path. And of course, the U.S. fights wars in Asia in part, if not large part, because of concerns about the spread of Chinese-style communism and their ability to infiltrate and that sort of thing. The thing is, for as much as Cold War concerns are so prominent and at the foreground of American thinking about China in these decades, they're only part of Chinese calculations as they're making foreign policy choices. There's two Chinas. You could say Taiwan is another winner of the Cold War. Because, of course, they survive as a result of the Cold War calculations. They're not reunited yet. But the kinds of decisions that they're making, that Mao Zedong or Zhou Enlai or people on the mainland are making, are caught up in things like domestic stability and economic growth, and how do we maintain control over this vast and disparate territory that hasn't had a single government controlling it in this way terribly well for quite a while. And so it has a lot of calculations, and they want to have good relations with the non-aligned movement and with different people who are involved in that. And so they make a lot of choices that are partly Cold War calculus, that are partly a product of the experience of decolonization, and that are partly about domestic stability. And so they're absolutely, you know, not falling into these lines. By the time the Sino-Soviet split is, you know, a decade in, they're splitting off from the Soviet Union. The U.S. realizes it a few years later, but it's they're not fitting into this neat calculus of one world is the Soviet world and the other world is the free world, and so they are an enigma for that. They're also an enigma because records are not terribly available. So even now, as we write these histories, we struggle with getting a full accounting of what's happening in Beijing or what the actual top level accounting is, because, you know, so many archives are, there was briefly the Ministry of Foreign Affairs archive was open for about 10 years, and then it sort of shut back down again. And then even when it was open, you know, it was a selection of what was available. And so there is sort of a wall of a veil of secrecy that we don't have a complete understanding of everything that was going into that accounting.
I just want to say, nuclear warfare. I would agree more than anyone else in this room that the possibility of it was real, and we came very close to it several times, including times most people don't even know we came close to it. Certainly was out there, and the projections that the Americans had for what this would look like, we're talking about hundreds of millions of deaths. So if we think of millions of deaths from the actual Cold War, hundreds of millions from the hypothetical Cold War, and probably that's an underestimate of what it would have been anyway, it's easy to say, sure, a million sounds pretty low when you're talking about 100 million. But I don't know. What I mean by a low bar, survival is not enough, right? We could do better as a species. We could do better as a country. Like, I'm glad we didn't all die in a horrible nuclear holocaust. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, when that's your bar for success, which is like, whew, we didn't all commit suicide. I mean, this would be like I'm going to drive home after this, and if I went to my wife and said, I made it back over the New Jersey Turnpike, and I didn't kill 10 people. And is it possible I could kill 10 people in the New Jersey Turnpike? Easily, right? Easily. You've all driven on it. But at the same time, that's like, what would that say about me if that was my line? And I sort of feel like with the nuclear issue, the amount of money spent, the amount of money and lives spent on these proxy wars, the immense apparatus that was mobilized, that didn't go away. As you point out, these things didn't end at the end of the Cold War. Some situations have gotten better since the end of the Cold War, hooray. Some have gotten worse since the end of the Cold War. I think the chance of an individual nuclear weapon going off is probably higher today than it was during much of the Cold War, especially the late Cold War. The odds of a big U.S.-Russia thing, hopefully low. But, you know, it's not really in my control. But we also ended the Cold War in a situation where it wasn't some unambiguous celebration. And this, just to get to your point on that, I think if the Americans had gone around and had a big ticker tape parade or did some kind of World War II style thing where we all got drunk, in retrospect, that would look pretty stupid. Because what has happened to Russia since the old... Did they become this great, glorious democratic state as transit? No. How is global communism doing? Well, China's doing pretty good, whatever that you want to call that. How about...
Socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Yeah, well, exactly, right. How about Latin America? Oh, well, we're still seeing like some really extended versions of Cold War stuff with the drugs problems going on there. I mean, these problems are deep. I'm sort of in the category of saying it didn't really end, and it ended really problematically. And we're going to be living with that for the next century or so, probably, if we don't all die.
Can I just pick up in terms of thinking about the different observers that, and I'm picking up a little bit on David's point about being a child of the Cold War, but also Manu's comment about the kind of the sort of modern pundit and the ways in which she sort of played the American audience very well, or even in terms of Meredith, your comment about propaganda, and I want to kind of introduce this idea of publics or Cold War publics in terms of thinking about the ways in which they perceived and understood and were mobilized or part of these policy calculations or these ideological movements. So where do these different publics fit in, whether it's an American public or an Indian public? If we're kind of thinking about these as audiences of or participants in this broader struggle, so where do they fit in this survival, but not quite, or sort of?
Can I answer this by just going back to this one other point that David made, which Alex just brought up, which is the Cold War ended, the United States won, and there was no ticker tape parade. There was no ticker tape parade that the Cold War ended, rather. There wasn't, literally. But there was figuratively. The United States preened around the world that it won. And people felt that, most notably in the ex-Soviet Union. They felt that the US was flaunting their victory. And that has repercussions, that we're seeing the repercussions of that right now, where the current leader of Russia is an ex-KGB, or maybe Kirk, I don't know. FSB, yes. hand who certainly, I think, it's fair to say, I think, still sees the world in Cold War terms. I don't think he thinks or accepts that the Cold War, A, is over, and B, that the US won. I think he thinks stage one is over, and I think he thinks that stage two is yet to be determined. That's what I think, anyway. Sorry. So in terms of publics, I think this is a reception to this thing, the who won and who's seeing it, how it's perceived very differently in different places in the world. In terms of sort of scholarship, when the US won, Francis Fukuyama wrote a famous book called The End of History. The popular takeaway of this book was that he was claiming that liberal democracy was the end of all forms of government, quite possibly. There might be challenges, but this was the basic takeaway. And therefore, the US was triumphant in many more ways than anything else because its form of life was now victorious, and it was just a matter of time before everyone else wound up in this place. So Francis Fukuyama is back right now, kind of renouncing and denouncing all of that, saying, well, history is clearly not over, but also, I never said what I said, people read my book wrong, and socialism should come back. So who knows?
Anybody else want to weigh in, or should we let the audience have their say and put new challenges for the rest of us up here?
I, just want to say that I think this question of how we all relate, and I think the audience is going to be a participant in that too, to the Cold War is incredibly relevant to this. And it's one of the challenges of being a historian, especially, I think, generationally as historians. My first political memory is the Berlin Wall coming down. Mm-hmm. And I remember it very acutely because they had just taught us in class which was the good Germany and which was the bad Germany. And it was very tricky because the bad Germany had a good name, you see. And then they one day said, oh, actually, there's just one Germany, and that map is wrong. And I was like, the map is wrong? How can maps be wrong? It's like rolls down, right? So this was very transformational for me as a you know, American child who at that point thought that, you know, if the map said it, it must be true. And I wonder if this is a sort of leitmotif for, you know, a lot of our rethinking about this stuff. I think one of the difficulties I run into when talking with people about the Cold War, especially World War II, but that's becoming less the case as people who have living memory of World War II are, you know, not as round as much, is that people are very rooted in the perspective of the publics at the time. And it's a super important perspective. Though the historian, of course, is supposed to get a remove of that to some degree and try to see the bigger. And I don't know how to square that while it's not that far away and we're clearly seeing all the repercussions of it, right? I mean, I don't want to say we shouldn't study the Cold War, it's too recent. But I do sort of think, I can't remember who's the Chinese leader who was supposed to have been asked about the French Revolution and then said, you know, it's too soon to tell. But and I know that that's a misquote and all that, but it's still such a good quote. But I also wonder with the Cold War, do we ultimately say it's too soon to tell? I don't know.
So, all right, we have a couple of students that with microphones, and I will ask you to please speak into the microphone. We can kind of raise your hand and identify yourself. If you keep your comments brief, we'll get more of them, and you'll inspire more insights from the panel up here. So why don't we start right over here? There's a question.
I'm listening to what you said. What everybody said, I'm looking at comparing the end of the Cold War and how the end of World War II ended and how the end of World War I ended, and what separates the two. There's a connection between the end of World War I and the end of the Cold War, because the United States did not control the countries that they were victorious over, and couldn't cleanse the government of the bad people and set a basis for a beginning a new government. Question being, you know, just to address that question.
So I guess in some extent to think about the shift from a, or kind of the extent to which we're now in the midst of a multipolar world, that even the victorious sides are kind of part of the broader participants in terms of shaping what this system looks like? Or I mean, I guess maybe the other piece would be to say, to what extent did the conflict really come to a conclusion, or is it still an ongoing conflict would be, I guess, be another way of thinking about what happens after the end of the First World War. Alex, I see you nodding your head in terms of, do you want to add anything more in terms of?
Well, I like bringing up the end of World War II often in this kind of context, because as Americans, we're taught the end of World War II, the best, right? Hooray, everything's over and bad. As historians, you realize, oh my God, this is like the beginning of this incredible unraveling and things get really dangerous and we almost kill the whole planet off. And this is the kind of ambiguity that I like thinking about and reintroducing, especially into my students, into their brains about this, because we have this sort of national story, which it is good that World War II ended and that we won and, you know, down with the Nazis, you know, thumbs up. On the other hand, you don't actually want to take that as a template for unambiguous success. If we ended a war and then it created as many problems as the end of World War II created for the world, you would say, oh my God, that was not a good ending. And this is, to me, some of the really complicated, problematic stuff that gets into it. I like the comparisons. Anyway, that's all I'll say.
Sorry, can I? I think if I understood the question correctly, the United States, after World War I, did not cleanse the opponents of bad governments, leading to more problems, but they did after World War II. Is that right? And so the Cold War is parallel to the World War I moment because it didn't do that again. So I'm a bit confused by the premise, because, number one, the mandate system and everything did cleanse. I mean, the Ottoman Empire was broken up. The Germans were, I mean, the Weimar Republic was new. So I'm confused by the premise. But let's take the assumption that that was a fact. And the U.S., did they learn a lesson after World War II that if you go in and you fix up a place and make it better, that it'll be okay? I think we might say the U.S. learned that lesson too well. The Cold War is a history of the U.S. knocking out governments across the world, and the Soviet Union does too. I mean, I'm not, the Cold War is about doing that. That's what how I started with this thing about imperialism. To set up sort of proxy allies where appropriate, and anyone or anything that sort of looked like it might challenge international security from that perspective had to be eliminated. And it was justified by that rationale. And coming back to the point of idealism, sorry, that we also talked about, there were true believers all over the place, and it's these true believers that caused this.
Maybe I wonder just also to throw out the idea of the question of timelines and beginnings and endings, right? To what extent is 1945 really an ending, whether we're talking about India or whether we're talking about China? And maybe one of the things to think about is you know, we were talking we began our conversation in terms of thinking about the end of the Cold War. I mean, part of this maybe to say is, well, when does it begin, or does this story begin in different moments for different places, different people, different arguments, and that, I don't know if that's another way of kind of thinking about the geographies of the Cold War with these multi-layered timelines is also one way of thinking about it, whether in East Asia or elsewhere.
Another question?
Question in the audience? Maybe here down in the front, we can...
Question about publics, and since we're in a Catholic institution, the Catholic Church for a long time had a very anti-communist reputation well before the Bolshevik Revolution up through John Paul II. But by the 60s and 70s began seeing cracks in that with liberation theology being developed in Latin America, the challenge for peace by the U.S. Catholic bishops. Did you find any other publics that went through a similar transformation of a position where they had a certain position at the beginning of the Cold War that found itself challenged as time went by?
So shifting, complicating versions of kind of ideological explanations of the Cold War.
I mean, you can look at some of these trajectories. There's a lot of groups, I'm thinking of scientists in particular, who go through a period of being mostly enthusiastic about some form of Cold War activity in the post-World War II era. They took away, not all of them, but many of them took away a lesson of, this is a good approach to science, this is going to be great, we're going to have more influence, we're going to have more research. And then by the 70s, you start to see a lot of people turning and saying, this is perverting what we're doing, we're tied up with the military, we're all tied up with classification problems that we don't want, and secrecy, this is not what we're about. And so you see fractures like that. You see protests on campus in the 70s of physics laboratories, which is a very weird thing. You don't see that in the 1950s at all. It's more of a glamorization of it. So there's certainly a lot, especially if you take a long sort of definition of the Cold War that goes out to the 80s or 90s, you see different groups that start very much willing to sign on with a lot of that stuff and then feel as it goes on and on and on that they start to shift their positions on it.
I mean, there's a couple examples from China. And I mean, just the sort of leading Republican views of China at the beginning of the Cold War changed dramatically over the course of a couple of decades, up to the point where Nixon is going, but also scholars and leaders and slowly over the course of the 1960s, ironically, mostly during the confusion of the Cultural Revolution, start making the case more and more that the United States needs to open to China, with the caveat that we're not really sure what's going on in China right now, because this is odd. But then you also see, just in terms of perceptions of people, not just their own ideas, Chinese immigrants go through a couple radical changes over the course of the Cold War that are related to the politics of the time, where Chinese immigrants were seen as sort of heroic and contributing to grand ideas of freedom during World War II and immediately after. And then there were Chinese immigrants who were who had voted with their feet and left the Chinese communist states, and so they're glorious for that reason. And then Chinese immigrants were probably spies in a communist fifth column for a big chunk of the 1950s. And then by 1966, Time magazine discovered that they were a model minority after all. So then it was the perception of Chinese goes way up again. And so you see, you know, the politics of the time having radical effects on how the public perceives this particular group.
Could I ask, though, just to follow up and to think about this question of anti-communism among nationalist Chinese, or even in terms of thinking about not just in terms of the United States, but also in terms of the ways in which, I mean, some of the people that you're looking wind up in very different places around East Asia, and in terms of how that one of the ways of thinking about this perhaps would be to think that it's not just in kind of East-West operations that are divides that we see these kind of ideological questions, but even among Chinese anti-communists, how does that change in similar ways, or is there a line that you could trace out for us in that context?
I'm not 100% sure I understand the question. Like Chinese anti-communism not following along the bipolar.
Well, so to what extent is anti-communism, is that help to explain who they are, or is it become a question about dealing with local politics in some place like the Philippines or Indonesia, or so again this question about maybe the larger context about whether this is a Cold War story at all, and that the extent to which anti-communism becomes a way in which we act as if it's a Cold War story, but the people that you're looking at complicate that story a bit more.
Okay, so in the context of Chinese migration. And it sounds like you're talking about specifically overseas Chinese migrating into Southeast Asia. In a lot of cases, they have a very complicated story because it's, as a population, they have a long history of being political in the sense that there's a lot of support for the Nationalist Revolution in 1911. But after World War II and in the 1940s and 1950s, this is a population that is largely just trying to survive. And so they're not terribly political and they're not terribly anti-communist. But they are a source of, they're briefly seen for this period in the 1950s by both Chinese governments and the United States as sort of the key to Southeast Asia. And so everybody tries to manipulate propaganda and attempts to seek their support on the assumption that that'll help turn the tide one way or the other across the region of Southeast Asia. It's sort of an astounding assumption to look back on now, but it's also a good example of the fact that they're living a life and they're living in a context and they're surviving in a way that has absolutely nothing to do with the bipolar conflict. They're not terribly interested, not even when USIS creates an entire Cantonese opera just for the people of North Vietnam. It doesn't actually stem the tide of anything in Vietnam, so I mean, I'm shocking you with that. But it's in fact, you know, this a context that doesn't really lend itself well to the larger bipolar conflict.
Can I just offer an additional response to the question? It occurs to me that one sort of shift in public understandings of why the U.S. did what it did in the Cold War goes back to the speech that Eisenhower gave in his farewell address when he warned about the potentially too strong of an influence of the military-industrial complex. With the passage of some years, and once the Vietnam War was very much on, and then there was tremendous opposition to the war, explanations developed and were highly publicized, at the scholarly level, but non-scholarly level. This is why the U.S. is doing what it's doing in Vietnam to serve the interest of the military and of the corporations, and you just sort of take that through the 70s and the 80s into the Reagan era, and why is the U.S. building up its nuclear warfighting arsenal to serve the interest of the military-industrial complex? So this became a significant understanding among the masses. I'm not saying most of American public opinion, but a significant portion of it, for better or worse.
And I suppose you mentioned scholars, that on some level we should talk about the historians too, that even in terms of, we're talking about revisionist history, that in talking about the explanations for the Cold War, there were quite explicitly a development during the Vietnam era in particular that talked about revising earlier thinking about the Cold War, that it was initially the Soviets to blame, but then in a more critical perspective, well, in fact, it was U.S. economic and military interests that were to blame, and that these interpretations, even among historians, are also shifting over that time, too. Other questions? There's a question up here in the corner.
So my question is,
okay. We'll go over here and then we'll get that one next. So,
so my question is for Dr. Oyen, that her, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, is the, in your work you talk about using migration as diplomacy. And my question is, broadly, I know you focus on the U.S. and China, but can that paradigm be expanded into, say, Latin America, the Bracero program, and what is the can be the broader implications of using migration diplomacy in a Cold War context?
So the first part of your question, it can absolutely be expanded, and there are a couple historians who are actually doing that work, who are looking at basically the idea is that migrants. Countries use migration policy, and migrants use the act of moving from one country to another in ways that have profound significance for foreign relations and for foreign policy. And so that's not a big leap or a big stretch. Broadly for the United States and U.S. immigration policy, all of U.S. immigration policy during the Cold War has a Cold War bent. The 1952 Immigration Nationality Act is premised on an idea of preserving American national security in a Cold War context. All of U.S. immigration laws before 1980 are about allowing, or all of U.S. refugee laws before 1980 are focused on refugees from communism. And so it's that countries like the United States use these laws to try and achieve foreign policy ends is absolutely undeniable, but it's also something that applies wherever they're looking in the world. So that's not just with China, that's migrants from coming anywhere else in the world. I don't remember what else. So I think that answers the question.
So since we jumped ahead, we'll take this other question at the back here.
I'm kind of circling back to the original proposition as to who won the Cold War. Looking at the relationship between the United States and Cuba, it seems like the last extension of the traditional Cold War, and I'm curious if the panel feels there's any discernible benefit to continuing that Cold War to either the American or the Cuban people.
Gosh, I think this is an issue that has a lot to do with the Cuban-American vote in Florida. I don't see how the Cuban public or American public is served well by this continuing, whatever you want to call it, embargo, whatever. I did just.
So maybe one question might also be to, in terms of thinking for the different publics that we've explored and that you've explored in your work, is to think about what are the lasting or powerful images that remain of the Cold War. And in terms of thinking about, well, in the United States, that somehow Cuba still does seem to have this Cold War resonance in terms of how people understand or make sense of the conflicts in which they find themselves. Are there other, and not just in an American context, are there ways in which these either ideologies or actions or policies continue to resonate and to matter for publics in terms of making sense of where they find themselves right now?
So can I? Yes. Well, look, I want to do a couple things. In terms of the public's question, you know, I don't want to answer about India. I mean, yeah, there were changes in India, but I just saw this movie Terminator, and it has me thinking about answering your question, because the not very good, but nostalgic film that just came out is a sequel to movies that came out before, and those movies are sort of classic sci-fi films, but very much in a Cold War aesthetic. So, and essentially, humanity does destroy itself in nuclear holocaust, but that's because the machines take over and set the Soviet Union and the US against one another in Judgment Day. That's the premise of the movie. Sorry to spoil it for you. So I was thinking about this because in when the original movie was released in the late 80s, that's what happens, and it's all doom and gloom. And then in the sequel, which came out in 1992, which is right after the Berlin Wall fell, there's a line in the movie, which is, can Judgment Day still happen? Because aren't the Russians our friends now? So it's a very interesting turn, because Russia suddenly is removed from its Soviet history and from communism. Communism might still be sort of a bad thing, but Russia no longer is, and the change is literally overnight. So publics, these things change all the time, and we should think about the ways in which Hollywood and television, all these things play a role in how we perceive what creates publics and so on. The other point I just want to make very quickly is that we've been using national frames, and I think that's a bit of a problem. So in the United States, for instance, there are lots of people, notably W.E.B. Du Bois and others leading race justice movements in the 40s and the 50s, who use languages of socialism, Marxism, and communism to advocate for race justice. These things get wrapped up in the language of the Cold War. And that, according to the historian Carol Anderson, ends up, well, forgive me, terminating these movements. And the result, the civil rights movement, is not what they had originally been aiming for. They've been aiming for something much more total. And because of Cold War dynamics, that sort of fizzled out. The point is, the United States is not one thing, nor are any of these other national frames, and that there are lots of people, important people and regular everyday people, who think all kinds of things. And so understanding all of that is important to the story too.
There's a question here in the middle.
So obviously, as we did, as most people know, the Soviet Union fell, but like still after that, there are a lot of like enclaves and stuff of like totalitarianism, especially China and stuff. Like, what do you think the fate of these, you know, countries that are, you know, especially after, you know, World War II and, you know, 1991, of it, you know, totalitarian ideas? Do you think that China might face like a similar fate to the Soviet Union, kind of just implode, or do you think that, you know, that ideology might persist throughout just, you know, the foreseeable future?
I mean, I think we've been predicting, people were predicting for years the idea that there would be post-Cold War, you know, the transformation of China. The problem with that is, of course, a lot of the transformation that was happening, that was giving a lot of encouragement in the 1980s, met a sort of intractable point in at Tiananmen Square on June 4th, 1989, with the idea that okay, so this is not a rapidly liberalizing China that's become more capitalist. So it's going to be something else. China now, just in the last few years, we've learned just how much China is probably not moving away from its current model of government and is in fact doubling down with the current status of the leader Xi Jinping. So it's actually, I think, a testament to the legacy and the the continuing power of the concept of the Cold War, that if you've read anything about U.S.-Chinese relations in the last year, you've probably read an article that started with something like, are we in a Cold War with China? Or, yes, we're now in a Cold War with China, or this is a new Cold War, this is not a new Cold War. And so it's the power of the concept now that we're trying to apply it to this relationship as well. I personally don't think the Cold War works that well as a explanation for what's going on with China and the U.S. now, but it certainly has power as a concept that it's constantly used to try and explain this relationship.
So we probably have time for one final question. If there, here's a leaping up to the front here, so why don't we...
I, too, am a child of the Cold War. I was born in 1950, and I remember all that stuff. But we were talking about Putin a little bit earlier, and I've been musing lately that, you know, he has been interfering in our elections, et cetera, and it occurred to me, maybe he's a really smart guy because nuclear weapons are very expensive, armies are expensive, and, you know, the computer is not. And so am I giving him too much credit, or did I just give him a good idea?
I think it's safe to say that all of these things can be true. I mean, he is spending a lot of money on nuclear weapons also. But we are, I think it's pretty clear that the Russians and other states as well have identified that the United States in its sort of incredible embrace of instant news and social media and all of these like wonderful uncontrolled vectors of information as a democracy is a really ripe, juicy target for all sorts of disinformation and playing with us and getting our populations riled up over things that aren't even, you know, real, what thing, and even getting riled up over things that are real, but getting riled up in ways that promote chaos and things like that. I think this kind of gets back to this, some of these other questions that have been coming around about the lesson of the Cold War, the enduring legacies of the Cold War. If you read the Cold War as like democracy wins, I think that's not a great takeaway. I think we have to read the fall of the Soviet Union as a very specific set of events that has a lot to do with Soviet history. It does have to do with you know, the overall interaction, but has to do with how they were running their own governments and problems they had that they had built into their system and not completed. And that we should not extrapolate from this democracy will win, or that totalitarianism is doomed to fall apart under its own edifice, at least on a time scale that would be useful to us. And I think that that's, to me, why I keep coming back to an answer of like, well, I mean, if you want to say the Cold War was this specific relationship and it has to have the Soviet Union in it, and so it ends the day the Soviet Union does, great. But historians, when we use a category like the Cold War, even World War II, any kind of like non-natural category, where we're imposing this large structure onto the past and saying, here's a useful framework for thinking about all of these different events and interaction. I mean, it has to be useful. And if the conclusion of there was a Cold War and it ended was, we're not still bound to all of these problems, and in fact, some of them are still going to get worse in various ways. Some of these things that we created during the Cold War to serve our Cold War interests, like the internet, may actually be in the next chapter of whatever we're in, the thing that destabilizes that same power that created it. I think we have to have a very fluid sense of possibility if we're imagining what the future is going to be, and we can't just take away, we won, we're always going to win. That's the wrong answer.
Alex, you know, on that point, It isn't just that the imminent future might hold that technology through this interconnected web will result in new forms of warfare, cyber warfare, and this, you know, sort of imminent use of deep fakes where we will no longer be able to tell what's real and what isn't. It's not just that human actors and national actors might use this. To the best of my understanding, but I would totally defer to you.
I'm at the engineering school, after all. Yeah. I'm not an engineer.
To the best of my understanding, where AI is headed, there are some frightening scenarios and some people who work in these areas are starting to sound some alarm bells. And so the future, the immediate future might be what you're talking about in your question, but the not so distant future might very well be those things that had been relegated to the realm of sci-fi not so long ago.
So we started in terms of thinking about who won the Cold War, and we're wrapping up, if not quite in the realm of sci-fi, at least thinking about the ways in which the boundaries of our conversation are hopefully expanded. And even if the Cold War is something between a hard historical definition and a brand that becomes a useful way of mobilizing policy or organizing historical conversations, at least it perhaps can ask help us to pose some more questions that we can use to interrogate our present. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you especially to these panelists who have shared their insights. This is the last of the revisionist history events for this semester, but watch the LePage Center calendar beginning in January. There will be a chance to learn some more and to think differently about these different pasts. But now please join me in thanking our participants for their contributions this evening.